Now we're joined by the experts at Vettafi, a new data analytics and thought leadership company that is transforming financial services from an industry to a community, one relationship at a time.
An area that I've been talking a lot about is Bitcoin versus gold.
So right now in the environment that we're in, a lot of investors are concerned over those rising rates.
Roxana, great having you back on the podcast.
Yeah, it's really great to be here.
All right, so look, you are our resident expert when it comes to thematic indexes and ETFs. And we're going to look at a very interesting category in e-commerce ETFs, which I'll tell listeners, even if you're not interested in this space, I've got to tell you, as I started digging into this, there are some really important macro considerations here, just as it pertains to the consumer and the impact of inflation and what's been going on in the economy. But Roxana, let's just start with the overall backdrop, which is that e-commerce is continuing to take market share from traditional brick and mortar retailers. And I'd love to have you start by explaining what's been driving that, because I think some people might think, well, you know, it made sense that e-commerce took off during the pandemic, right? Everybody was buying online. But now that things have mostly gotten back to normal, I think some people think, well, that should be more beneficial for brick and mortar. So what's been going on here just at a high level?
Yeah, so first of all, I love talking about this sector. I love e-commerce. I've been following it for years back when I worked as a transportation logistics analyst. And the growth in this segment has just been happening for years, long before COVID even happened. So if you look at some of that public data out there, the U.S. Census Bureau releases some of that quarterly. We saw that e-commerce has been growing at a faster pace than retail sales on a year-over-year basis, basically as far as 4Q 1999. So, you know, obviously we saw a lot of that peak during COVID, and you know, that's when many of these investors got excited, but you know, like with most things, when we see a pull forward of that magnitude, you know, that's not really a sustainable growth rate. So, you know, after COVID, when that growth was normalized, e-commerce growth was still positive, but it just grew at a slower pace than total retail sales. So, you know, I think when that happened, the space sort of got a little bit less exciting for those that saw it take off during 2020. But, you know, if you really look at it, if you really look at that data, you know, penetration of total market share was in the mid 14% range compared to 16% in the pandemic. But that was still like far above those pre-pandemic levels that were closer to about, you know, maybe like 11%. So, you know, when I look at this data, you know, first, just to give a little bit of background, I always compare year over year, not sequentially, because, for example, when you're looking at that 4Q data, that includes Christmas shopping, so that's always going to be higher than 3Q. You know, and I always adjust for motor vehicle and gasoline sales, not just because it's historically volatile, but that's also not a huge contributor to e-commerce sales in general. So after you make those adjustments, we really saw e-commerce resume that normal pace in 2Q22. And since then, it's been growing, you know, quite at a fast pace again. And we have 4Q e-commerce data is not really coming out until mid-February, I believe. You know, but we already have that retail sales data from 4Q. And you can look at the non-store retailer segment there and sort of apply an adjustment factor and get an approximation of what you think e-commerce sales will likely be. And it's looking like it's continuing that trend of outpacing retail sales. So I'm estimating personally about 15% of total retail sales in 4Q22 versus 14.5 during 4Q21. And I think that about matches up with what we've been hearing about holiday sales. So, you know, I think the space is going to continue to grow, especially when you consider those consumer preferences. And, you know, that environment that we're in, it's really interesting because obviously, you know, we all know the internet has penetrated our lives. We're almost too connected. You know, it's easy to pull out a phone or an iPad or even like your Apple Watch and order something from the internet. But, you know, we're also in this environment when we still have a good amount of people still working at home. You know, and that's sort of like leftover from the pandemic, but I think a lot of that is a little bit more longer term, because if you look at how much people are driving now, it's quite fascinating, because passenger vehicle miles in 2022 is still below pre-pandemic levels. And if you look at transit ridership, you know, for public transit, that's almost 40% below those levels in early 2020. So people aren't really leaving the house for work as much anymore. So you don't really have people stopping at the mall or at the store on their way home from work. We're on the internet all day, and it's just easier to buy something online because we're not already out there. And, you know, it's not just the people working from home. We're also seeing this in the more price-sensitive consumers. You know, inflation has shown some signs of moderating, but, you know, there's still a lot of pressure on the consumer. You know, people are making memes about those egg prices. Rental prices are still pretty high. Mortgage prices are still pretty high. So there's been a lot of pressure, and it's really eating into the more price-sensitive consumer. So first of all, people would rather not spend a lot of money on gas, right? They'd rather stay at home if they could to save that money. And then I think what's even more interesting is you're having people become more strategic in their purchases, and it's actually easier to do that online, you know, where you can sit there and you can compare prices and discounts on multiple stores and plan out what exactly you're going to buy. And I think another interesting point to make there has been credit card spending. You know, we've seen these charts about credit card debt increasing, you know, maybe 15 to 20% over the year. But I think what's really interesting is if you look at credit card late payments, it's not really as bad as you think. It's about the same as it's always been. So it makes me wonder if people are using credit cards as part of their strategy, maybe opening those accounts in order to take advantage of those sign-up bonuses or the store credit card discounts. So, you know, it's just really an interesting environment we're in because people, you know, they obviously still want to buy things and, you know, the wallets are a little bit tighter, so they're looking for different ways and different strategies in order to buy things. So I think this is why e-commerce has been taking off quite a bit compared to total retail sales.
Yeah, and when I mentioned macro considerations at the top, that's really what caught my attention was this relationship between inflation and the consumer in e-commerce, because as you mentioned, if you think about this, consumers are more price sensitive, and so they do become more strategic about how and when they spend their time and money. And so it would make sense that could be beneficial for the e-commerce category as a whole. So, you know, maybe obvious to some people, but I really like that interplay there. Roxanna, something else that I found interesting about this space is that obviously people are familiar with companies like Amazon and Etsy, eBay, DoorDash, but I'd love to have you talk more about a company like Walmart, who I think many still view as that traditional brick and mortar retailer, but they're increasingly expanding into e-commerce. So can you talk more about that and perhaps what that means for the e-commerce space overall?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's interesting because we just talked about consumer behavior, and I think a lot of people sort of talk about that when they talk about e-commerce, but I think it's also very much driven by the way retailers behave as well. And I think there was this misconception that it was e-commerce versus brick and mortar, and it was sort of an either-or situation. And the fact is that they're more complementary to each other. And many large retailers, like Walmart, for instance, they've realized this, and that they have to be flexible, and they have to move toward a more omni-channel strategy. And omni-channel is just a fancy logistics term that basically just refers to integrating online shopping with in-person shopping. For example, you know, you have consumers now that buy online and then they pick up in store, or they buy in store and then they do the returns online. So now there's really more of an integration between the two. And, you know, that trend has also been going on for many years. But I think, you know, many of these retailers, the pandemic really made them more aware of that because, you know, they couldn't really be open to consumers. So they had to maybe do the buy online, pick up in store thing. So if you look at these large retailers like Walmart, you know, Walmart has previously stated, you know, in the earnings calls, transcripts, et cetera, that they didn't fully appreciate how much customers needed e-commerce at first. So, you know, they've been growing that part of their business for the past few quarters in line with the total U.S. e-commerce growth, which is something I think that, you know, helps a much larger company in general, because if you think about steps you need to take to modernize your operations at a retailer, you know, whether it's e-commerce or brick and mortar, a lot of those steps are going to be the same. You're going to need better inventory tracking. You're going to need better website data so that customers can see item availability or discounts or price comparisons. And all of that can easily be translated into e-commerce channels. So it's a really natural step in the evolution of retail.
Yeah, such an interesting example. Roxanna, one thing I'm curious about, you know, already here you've mentioned some of the positive drivers within the e-commerce space overall. But if I look at an ETF like, say, iBuy, the Amplify Online Retail ETF, that was down 56% last year. Or if we look at iShip, which I know S Network provides the index for that, the First Trust S Network e-commerce ETF, that was down 34% last year. Was that because the space just got ahead of itself valuation-wise during the pandemic? Or what was happening here? Because given, you know, what you've already laid out, things seem fairly bullish overall, and you like to think stocks are forward-looking. So what happened last year?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of it was the fact that investors had started to become sort of disenchanted with the e-commerce space. You know, they weren't seeing those high growth rates anymore. It wasn't as popular anymore. And, you know, another major factor is that a lot of these companies are either tech stocks or at least tech oriented. And I think investors are also, you know, very cautious with these sort of higher risk, growthier tech investments last year. And then, you know, we were also in an environment where we had lower ad revenue, which was hurting some of the tech companies. And, you know, even if these companies had higher top line growth driven by that e-commerce demand, you know, you also had to look at the margins, and a lot of them were experiencing higher costs. You know, you had some of these micro factors weighing in on that overall e-commerce demand. And so that was sort of weighing in on the space.
Yeah, and I'll note things have started on a bit of a better foot so far this year. If you look at iBuy, that's up over 20%. iShip is up 11%. So, you know, clearly, at least so far this year, things have been more positive. In terms of ETFs in the space overall, so we just mentioned iBuy and iShip, but there are a number of options here. There's the ProShares Online Retail ETF, ticker ONLN. GlobalX has an e-commerce ETF, ticker eBiz. Goldman Sachs, who will join me later, I mentioned they have GBuy, which is their future consumer equity ETF. And there are others out there. What do you think should be some of the key considerations if investors do want to look at this space?
Yeah, so, you know, I think the good thing with e-commerce is that you have a lot of options as an investor, because it's a category that I think is really hard to sort of categorize it in one bucket. It's really a very much a multi-sector theme. So it isn't just necessarily a consumer pointing and clicking a mouse on the internet. You know, it's everything involving a retailer's inventory, its supply chain, its website, and then there's the consumer clicking the mouse and ordering the product. But then there's also getting that product to the consumer once they click that mouse and ordered it. So, you know, as an investor, there are multiple ways to access this theme from an ETF standpoint. You know, obviously you have the broader e-commerce ETFs, you know, that are relatively diversified. Like, you know, we mentioned ISHP. It holds online marketplaces, online retailers, content navigation companies, and even e-commerce infrastructure like delivery companies, you know, and that's like FedEx and UPS. And those sort of companies are actually really essential in e-commerce because, you know, they specialize in that sort of last mile delivery when they take products direct to the customer. And then you can look at, you know, the ETFs you also mentioned, like there's iBuy and there's ONLN, which, you know, those basically focus on those internet companies that take those direct internet purchases. Basically what I was saying before about the consumer, you know, pointing and clicking the mouse. And then you can get even deeper than that. You can look at ETFs like DTRE, which hold logistics REITs. And those are basically the warehouses used within the e-commerce supply chain that sort of serve as a distribution centers where they keep the inventory and then distribute directly to the customer. So there's a lot of different ways to approach this. So I think that's sort of what makes the space more interesting to an investor who's interested, you know, because they have more than one option. They have more than one way to access the strategy.
That's an excellent summary. I mean, you hit on some of the high points that I saw as I looked under the hood of these ETFs. I mean, some of these own, for example, Walmart, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Some of them don't, right? You mentioned the package delivery companies like UPS and FedEx. I thought a good one, logistics REITs that you hit on. You really have to look under the hood because there are some pretty significant differences here. Any quick thoughts on ETFs focused on international stocks or something like the EMQQ, Emerging Markets Internet and E-Commerce ETF. I know iShip has a global presence. Just any thoughts on those?
Yeah, just, you know, e-commerce is a very, very global concept. And I think, you know, I personally talk about it from a U.S. perspective just because it's easier for investors to relate and understand. But, you know, China actually has a larger e-commerce presence than the U.S. You know, they have, you know, we probably all heard of Alibaba and JD.com. You know, they have a ton of e-commerce websites over there. And, you know, other emerging market countries, if you think about it, they have a lot of growth potential from an e-commerce perspective. Because you think about how far internet penetration still has to go in those countries. You know, they do have a lot of room for growth. So I think international ETFs are a pretty good way to take advantage of the space globally.
Roxanna, just a couple minutes left here before I let you go. I want to switch gears, and I'm going to have you help me build a little bridge to my next segment.
Okay.
I'll be joined in just a moment by Grayscale's Dave Lavelle, who, as I'm sure you're aware, they offer a future of finance ETF, ticker GFOF. And Dave probably won't like this, but I'm going to broadly lump that into the blockchain ETF space, right? Crypto-related ETFs. And if you look so far this year, you probably heard me at the top, that space has taken off. Something like GFOF, that's up over 50%. And I'm just curious, as someone who follows this category pretty closely, what are you seeing underneath the surface here? Is there anything that's been sticking out to you that's driving this type of performance so far this year?
Yeah, so I think there's already a lot of renewed interest in crypto, and I think there's going to be some more. Because if you look at the top 10 best performing ETFs this year, so far, five out of 10 are crypto-related ETFs, which is pretty impressive. So, you know, a lot of that is driven by macro factors, like you mentioned, you know, people, you know, that inflation, signs of inflation moderating, maybe a little bit less aggressive of a Fed. So it's a lot of macro factors and the fact that consumers are a little bit less risk adverse than they were last year. But I also think specifically the space has matured. Investors and analysts are becoming smarter about some of these bad actors and becoming a little bit more realistic about what sort of returns to expect. You know, we can't obviously expect those high returns that we saw a couple of years ago. So I think we'll see some interesting things happen in 2023 for crypto.
Yeah, and I think obviously it helps. I mean, you look at Bitcoin and some of the larger cryptos out there, they've had a nice bounce. Obviously, it was a very brutal year in 2022, but I think some people like to look at the blockchain ETFs as a quote-unquote leverage play on crypto, sort of how gold mining stocks are with gold, right? If gold's up, sometimes you'll see the gold miners up more than that. It's like a leverage play. I think some people think that's similar for the blockchain ETF space, but clearly the underlying cryptos have been a driver as well. But Roxanna, we'll have to leave it there. Excellent stuff this week. So great having you back on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Roxanna Islam, Associate Director of Research at Vettafi.